Okay, we are at the 7:30 mark, so I am now going to mute all, and as usual, you have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the deck in a PDF form, as well as contents of the chat and the audio track will be going up on our website. And with that, I will throw it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, Chris, and we're going to kick off with a couple of follow-up things from last week. And right at the end of the meeting, there was some discussion on Windows Explorer or File Explorer, whatever it's called these days. And one of the items was the arrangement of the columns of information that you see when you load Windows Explorer. And it turns out there are lots and lots of these things. Windows seems to decide by default what it's going to show. The question was, how can we get rid of some of those things and just have file name, date, and size? And this is what we're talking about. Here's Windows Explorer, and you're looking up folders and some files, and you're getting name and date and size, but you also get type, which is not very useful to me because I always display the file extension, so I know what type it is, and tags, I never use tags. So those two things are always redundant for me. Anyway, it turns out it's really easy to change those for any given folder. If you just right-click on the list, on the line where these things are, then it pops up a list, and you can see which ones are checked, and you just uncheck type and uncheck tags, and check the ones you want, and in future, it will show you those things. Trouble is, that only does that one particular folder. However, if you navigate now to View, and then over here to Options, it will pop up this Folder Options window, and now you can apply your selection to all folders. Well, at least you think you would be able to. It actually says you can apply this view to all folders of this type. So it turns, well, so the question is, what type is any given folder? And is there just a generic setting which says do this to all folders irrespective of what type it is? And the answer is yes and no. And Windows, basically, File Explorer, it defines a number of folder types. So it has things like documents, general items, pictures, videos, music, and those kind of things. So those are the kind of types. If you want to change it for all of them, then basically what you have to do is follow the previous instructions, which was to right-click on the folder and set up the ones you want. So you essentially fix one folder, and then you have to go to each of these different types and apply the same thing to those types of folders. So basically it means you've got to do, one, two, three, four. You've got to do it five times, and then all your folders will show up with the whatever your preferred settings are. And since I think this is kind of a one-off deal, I'm hoping that Windows will respect my choices forever, feature updates notwithstanding. And personally, I don't have a problem just doing that as a one-off type exercise. However, when I was researching this on the web, I found that there's at least one third-party application called WinSetView, which basically does this automatically for you. You tell it what you want, and then it does it on a kind of a global basis. I haven't tried that, so here's the warning, untested. But it's there if that kind of thing interests you. Okay, the second thing that came up was a question about what I read on the web is the green bar of death. Elizabeth wanted to know, in File Explorer, you have this irritating green line, she says. So it's this green progress bar right here, which goes from left to right. And in her case, she says it never stops. It may just be taking a long time. I don't know. What's it doing? Well, clearly it's some kind of progress bar. Whatever File Explorer is doing, it's telling you how far it's got. Exactly what it's doing, I'm not sure. And Chris took a look at this, and I took a look at this, and neither of us could get it to... We couldn't reproduce the green bar on our system. Chris thought it was if you had thousands of video files, image files, JPEGs, for example, and it was trying to load all these images and look at what they were and how big they were and that kind of thing. And it just took a long time to kind of do the indexing, as it were. But when he tried it with 3,000 files, it did it almost instantly. So that didn't work. I thought it might have to do with large files. So I tried that on some folders where I have some big files in there. I still couldn't get the green bar to come along. So I did the other thing. Well, it turns out I did find one way to do it, and I'll come back to that in a second. But when you don't know what happens, what you do, you ask ChatGPT. You say, in Windows 10, why is a green bar, progress bar displayed in File Explorer? And it says, well, it's probably because of syncing to a cloud storage service, typically Microsoft OneDrive. And so you're either copying files or syncing files or doing whatever, and it's taking a while to upload them to the cloud, and so you're seeing a progress bar as it goes along. And now the only problem with that is I don't actually use OneDrive, so that wouldn't be the explanation for me. And the thing I tried, which I knew I'd seen this thing somewhere before, but I couldn't remember what it was. But I was thinking maybe it is literally a kind of a caching issue or an indexing problem, and basically it's slow access to a folder somewhere. So I stuck in a CD-ROM drive, and sure enough, I got a green progress bar. So I asked ChatGPT once he'd given me this answer, him or her, I said, what about just reading a CD-ROM? Then he says, well, maybe that's not going to be OneDrive, but there's all kinds of other reasons. So it could be an indexing type issue when you're trying to index or parse the contents of the disk. Here's Chris's problem where you've got tons of image files or video files, and it's trying to generate thumbnail previews. So that could take a while. Here's my example, reading large files. You must need a lot of large files, I guess. And then the other thing is, he says sometimes maybe it's an antivirus program kicking in and trying to scan the disk that you're reading, and that's taking a while. So again, the File Explorer is, the process is held up or whatever. So that's as far as I got. If anybody else has any bright ideas, then I guess we can discuss those maybe later.
I've also found the green bar appears when you have indexing on, and it thinks that it has to go to the index to find something that you've entered in the search field.
Yeah, that could be, Tom. I actually turned indexing off quite a long time ago because I now use everything. And I don't see that problem with everything, for example. Go on.
Indexing is pretty slow to show you stuff, but it looks inside of files as well as looking at the name. So it can be useful, although I seem to have had very little use for it.
So I see a couple of things in the chat. Micheline says she gets it when she searches in File Explorer. So I guess what kind of search you're doing, if you're looking inside files, it will take a long time, so that may slow things down. Linda says she sometimes gets it when copying photo files. So, yeah, that could be that, again, it's taking time to copy a bunch of files, maybe large files, from one location to another.
Yeah, it takes time to copy them, but then it just takes longer than it should. So I just sit there for the amount of time I think it should take. Then I close Windows Explorer. I go check and see if the files are complete. They usually are. It's just sometimes that green bar just needs a re-kick. It just keeps going and it's not meaning anything anymore.
Okay.
I've had it happen as well with external drives to go to sleep. And it's brief enough that I don't really care, but it usually takes about 5 seconds for the drive to wake up. And so that can cause it. I find that the best solution for this is to find a replacement for File Explorer. So I use Total Commander. And, you know, I never have any speed problems or anything like that at all.
It looks like Ed is commenting on the same kind of thing, Chris. If there's a shared on a network and it's not live, yeah. Then it tries to exist. It tries to access a non-existent drive, and so it thinks about it for a while. And Elizabeth wants to know, how do you know when you have indexing on? Okay, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to look at that.
Yeah, you can find it in Control Panel. Certainly indexing is in there. So if you go to Control Panel and then search on index, let me just find here. Let's just do, yeah, there's an indexing options in there, and you'll be able to see if it's turned on or not. My Dow tells me that I've got 31,725 items indexed. And indexing is complete, but it will kick in periodically and re-index things or look for new stuff and things like that. So yeah, Control Panel, indexing options.
And just a word of warning, if you turn indexing off because you're seeing the progress bar, it also means you won't be able to search in File Explorer anymore because the search process requires indexing to be turned on.
Depends on what you're searching on. Like if you're just searching on file names, I believe it can still find it. I think it can still work, but I'm not sure because that's just, I don't use
file. I've run into that problem though, Chris. I don't remember the exact details, but it can be.
If you search at the for a newsletter, I did write an article on for the newsletter a couple of years back on turning off indexing. So you can probably find it by searching at the OPCUG website. If you search on indexing, it'll probably turn up. If not, give me a shout and I can dig it up and send you the URL.
Okay, all right. So thanks everyone for that. So moving along, we have an update here from Bob Walker on video download helper. Are you going to share your screen, Bob?
Yes, I am, but I know that the host has disabled my screen sharing, so.
Well, I didn't disable it, but I didn't enable it. So hang on a sec. And there you go. You should be able to share now.
Okay.
There we go.
Okay. Just a quick note. I get the green bar of death. One of the very, very few things I use File Explorer for is doing some searches, and it'll go through the searches on the directory and file names looking for stuff, and the green bar gets almost all the way over to the right, then it'll sit there for that last half inch forever as it goes through the file contents. So that's what's sort of happening with it. This is an update here to Video Download Helper. And we looked at Video Download Helper. It's a browser extension and it has a companion app. And we looked at it for Firefox and Google Chrome web browsers back in May 4th, 2022. Video Download Helper allows the user to very easily download videos in just two clicks, or just the audio portions of the videos, which takes three clicks, from sites like YouTube that streams videos through HTTP, HLS dash, and some other similar formats. I focused mostly on the Firefox version because at the time, Google, who's the owner of YouTube, block Video Download Helper and other download apps from downloading YouTube videos when you're using Google Chrome. They don't mind you downloading other people's videos through when you're using Google Chrome, just their own. The best features of Video Download Helper are that it's very quick and easy to use. It downloads the entire video cleanly from beginning to end without any of the extraneous material at the beginning and the end that you can get using video screen capture tools. It filters out any of those really very incredibly annoying ads that you often get in the middle of many of the YouTube videos, especially the longer videos. And it can download several videos and or audio tracks concurrently as long as you keep Firefox open until the last download is finished. So you can go to other videos on YouTube. You can go to other sites on Firefox. And as long as you keep Firefox open while the downloads are happening, they'll all finish up. I've downloaded up to 7 or 8 videos concurrently doing this. However, our good friends at Google, who are the owners of YouTube, Google desperately wants you to live your entire Google life online and in the cloud so they can track and monetize everything that you do. Because remember, you are their product. Once you download something, they lose the ability and any control over you to do all that. So back last July, I reported how Video Download Helper had stopped working for many users. It was not entirely clear at the time whether this was due to a Windows update or to some other problem, or the most likely culprit, what it turned out to be, to Google blocking Video Download Helper and other download tools, even when you're using other browsers like Firefox. And at the time, the most recent release of Video Download Helper only partially fixed this problem, and only for a very limited number of videos. And about the same time, the ability of VLC Media Player and some other download apps to download YouTube videos also stopped working for many users. So back on August 22nd this year, Video Download Helper released version 8.0.0.6, and this works with Firefox version 42 or later. In casual testing so far, and I've done a lot more testing since I actually wrote this little mini presentation, it seems to correct all the downloading problems for virtually all the videos. Now, keep in mind that it doesn't download videos that use an embedded video player on the site, like you get with news stories or recipe videos or a lot of others. And this is true even if they use the YouTube embedded video player, which I use on the websites I keep track of, or I'm the webmaster of. If the embedded video does use the YouTube video player, you can right-click on the video while it's playing, copy the YouTube URL, paste this copy into the of the URL into the search bar on Firefox to open up the source video directly, and then use Video Download Helper to download the video like you would normally use it. However, if the embedded video you want doesn't use the download embedded video player, you can still download that video using a video screen capture tool like NCH's debut video capture and screen recording software. And I demoed this back in May 2022. Keep in mind that this usually gives you a lot of extraneous material at the beginning and the end of the video, and it doesn't filter out the ads in the middle of the videos. The Video Download Helper is available as an extension for Firefox and Google Chrome if you can tolerate Google's nonsense. The Video Download Helper itself is free, and it doesn't require any registration. However, to do it properly, you need to use a converter or a helper app. And the unregistered version of this app is free, but the registration is only approximately U.S. 16 U.S. dollars, and it's usable on a reasonable number of computers. You're not limited to only one or two computers with it. The developers have to eat too, and so I didn't mind paying the money. If you don't register the helper app, any of the videos will have a QR code in the converted or aggregated videos, and you won't be able to download just the audio portion of the videos. And that's the end of the update on Video Download Helper. However, just a heads up, last week at Q&A, in his review of BleachBit, Alan mentioned that in trying to download BleachBit, he had quite a bit of difficulty finding the actual BleachBit download link amongst all the much more prominent download links that downloaded something that he did not want. Unfortunately, this problem is not unique to BleachBit. I'm finding more and more downloaded sites trying this type of bamboozlement. So let's be careful out there. I don't quite understand the reason a lot of these sites keep on trying to sideways load you unless you're getting a fee for leading you to another site. Because even some of the update sites for apps you pay for, when you try and download the update, they try this kind of nonsense. That's all I have for tonight.
I'm sure they are getting paid for sending people to other places to download other pieces of crap.
Oh, no doubt.
Thanks, Bob. And Tom's put a note in the chat window that you can pay for YouTube Premium. It's about $100 a year. But then you can watch YouTube with no adverts, and you can download to your PC or your phone, and some videos get more bandwidth. And Chris notes, you want to talk about that, Chris? uBlock Origin?
Yeah, sure. I think it was Tom who first mentioned this, and I tried it out, and it's great. uBlock Origin, it can block a lot of ads and stuff like that. But one of the things it can do, which is really cool, is that if you're at YouTube, you don't get ads. And so it seems to eliminate all of the ads, including ones that are in the middle of videos that are playing and so forth. They just don't seem to show up. And I think it's just the default configuration of uBlock Origin. It's very configurable. There's lots of options in it, but I don't think I changed anything. And it's great. It just, I never see ads in on YouTube. So I pasted in the URL to the Chrome Web Store to get that. The trick to it, if you want to use any, like if you go to with the browser that you want to install it into, so it'll work with any Chromium browser like Edge and Vivaldi and all the rest of them that are Chromium based. Go to that link using the browser you want to install it in, install it, and it'll install it in there rather than being in Chrome or anything else. Yeah, okay. And Tom mentions there's a Firefox add-in as well. Yeah.
All right. So thanks very much, Bob, for that. And our second contribution of the evening is from Linda. And she's going to be doing part three of the photo editing series.
Okay. And do you have one more slide, Alan?
I do, yes.
Oh, okay. So we'll start with that. So, so part three, we did the part one, straightening, cropping, and lighting. We'll do some of the editing tools tonight, maybe not all of them, and then the next time I'll do masking and any leftover tools. So next. So I want to look at spot removal because someone did ask last time about restoring old photos, and I use it a lot for that, but also small objects or lines, especially if the background is very plain, like a telephone wire, it's really good at taking those out. I'll look at the fixing the red eye. Softening your skin, so for facial lines, often it's very handy in harsh light. How to use the blur function, had the sharpen function, and the clone function is not part of the free Photoscape X. You do have to pay for that. It's a one-time purchase for the whole program. There are more things in the paid version, but the main thing it has is the clone brush. Everything else is, you know, you could live without it. The free version has a lot, but it does not have the clone. And that's about $70 Canadian. It's not a subscription. It's just a one-time thing. Okay.
Well,
so
I'm just going to interrupt there before I forget about it. One thing that's handy too is that at $70, you can install it on up to 10 computers.
Right.
So yeah. That can cut down the unit price quite a bit.
That's true. Yeah. No, it's a really good deal. So just before I get started, I've just got, can you see my screen, Chris?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to review for people who aren't aware. A lot of what I'm going to show tonight, last week, it's all going to happen on the right side of your screen. So if you do have your Zoom gallery there, either click on the whole box and drag it to the left, or click on the little single dash there, and that will minimize the gallery, and you'll be able to see what I'm going to demo. Okay, so we're back into Photoscape X, and I'm going to just drag in my first photo. So the first thing I'm going to do, I'm actually going to start off with Red Eye because it's really easy. So I'm just going to drag that in. We're going to go to the tools on the very top menu at the very far right, the tools menu, and we're going to go to Fix Red Eye. And it's a very easy one. You can scroll in with the slider at the bottom here, but the control scroll wheel also works in this program. And then you just need to get a sort of appropriate size of the eyeball, appropriate size of brush to cover the eyeball nicely. But if you do go a bit beyond the eye, it's not critical because it's only looking for red. If I went too far and it got some pink or red from the rest of her face, that would be bad. But because it's just looking for red, it's going to find it there, and it's going to find it there and cover it up. Make sure you're at 100%. If you're less than 100%, you'd have to do it multiple times because it'll only, you know, erase part of the black, part of the red, and some of the red will show through. So that's it for Red Eye, and then you just save it under new name or overwrite the current file. So we'll get out of that one. The next one I'm going to show is the Spot Healing Brush. So I'll spend a bit of time on this one. So the first example is going to be a photo restoration that I did on this image. So again, I'm just going to scroll in. And the easiest thing to do first for spot removal is remove some spots. So, you know, you can have a small brush. It takes less time. But it's basically looking around the area and saying, what kind of pixels are in this area? What can I replace these dots with that looks sort of like what else is in the area? And so when you're doing things like this where there's a very clear background, that's no problem at all. Now, be careful when you get onto faces because any amount of sort of recreation of the pixels can distort a face. So I usually get in really tight, and I'm very careful with the size of my spot healing brush. So there's one on her eyebrow there. I would go down even smaller because any little change on an eyebrow or something like that can make the face look weird or just not the person you know. So that's basically what I would do for spots. And I'm not going to do them all, obviously. But the thing I like about this spot removal brush is you can do lines. So I can just drag this down. You can't do that in Windows Photos. You can only do spots. So I'm going to take that. Now, I usually limit myself to a section where it has a very similar background. And then it doesn't get confused. And I just go down and drag these ones or these ones. Now, the other one I'm going to do on this photo, I'm just going to scroll over here because I want to fix this one on her foot because I don't want to crop that out. And then I just you just play around. Sometimes it's happy. Sometimes it's not. You have to do it again. And I come down from the top. And that's basically it. It does a pretty good job. So I'm going to just zoom out here. So I would work away on that for a while. Then I would just throw it back into edit. And then I'd crop it. Well, maybe not that far because I want to make sure I get a little foot in. So we'll start from the bottom here. And just, you know, you don't need the whole chair and things like that. So don't do any more of these touch-ups than you need. But then you can sort of see, okay, I've got to do that area and a few more spots, and you can do that with the brush. So that's just an example of how easy it is to do the photo restoration with that brush. Okay, the next example I'm going to show where we can use the same tool is this image. Now, I like the bird and everything, but I want to crop it in a bit. So I'm going to do my crop first, and I'm going to say, well, you know, I just kind of like to have the bird sort of more at the rule of thirds and, you know, just have it not distraction of the rest of the tree or this evergreen on the corner. So I'm going to say yes, and that's nice. I kind of like that. The bird's in the right position. I just have a little bit of this garbage that I want to clear up. We don't need that tree. It's not adding anything. So I'm going to hit the tools again. I'm going to go back to the spot healing brush, and I'm going to just do little bits at a time. It probably would do fairly big chunks because it has that plain background. If you don't have a plain background, then you need to take a little more time with it. But when it's a pretty plain background, but you see, sometimes it just doesn't get happy, and you just got to do it again and again. And it will be different every day. You could do this tomorrow and do it in two strokes. So something like that, and then I would just save that instead. Okay, and then the last one I'm going to do is, this is very handy for removing things like this sign, okay, or this sign over here. So we just paint it, and because there is a fair amount in that background that's similar, it probably won't have any difficulty with it at all. And then we're going to zoom in, and I'm going to get rid of this sign. Just going to paint over that and see what kind of tree it creates. It created a really beautiful tree yesterday. We'll see what it does today. There, beautiful. Looks like a tree to me. So it's just really, really handy to get rid of things like that, or trash, or, you know, somebody drops something. Like on this picture here, somebody, I took this picture early in the morning, so I didn't notice, you know, somebody's left their running shoe here, and there's a glove over here, or sandals or something. It's that kind of thing. So it's really a handy tool to have. And you can take out this piece, but I won't spend any more time on that. Okay, so the next one, soften skin. So we'll go back to the toolbar, and we're going to pick soften skin. And this is really nice for facial lines when you're in harsh light, either like in this photo, I've got me and my mom, we've got daylight coming in this way, we've got a fairly strong lamp over on the left here, and it's just trying to soften things up a little bit, if the person wants it. If they don't want it, then don't do it. But in this instance, you can just sort of, you just drag, you just paint over it. I'm at 100% strength, but it still won't do a really, really drastic amount of, you can see it's very subtle. And then I'm just going to move over to me and just paint along those kind of lines, frown lines, that kind of thing. It's very subtle. If I went back out, you'd be hard pressed to see. I'll do a compare, the before and the after. It's, you'd really have to look, but if you want, you can go in and do it again. So I hit apply, and we're now back at 100% again. And let's zoom out a little bit, and I can repaint that area if I want. But don't end up looking like Michael Jackson, because not a pretty look. But it's just to let you know that that's available, because sometimes lighting can be very harsh, and it just accentuates those shadows. Okay, so the next one is blur. I'm going to see if I've got a better photo here. I'm going to use this photo. You know what? I think I'm going to leave blur for next week, because you never want to blur the entire photo. You usually want to blur only a portion, and that's masking, and we're going to do that next week. So I'm going to leave that one for next week. So the next one I'm going to do is the sharpen tool. So we're going to go back in to our tool list. Actually, I'm going to do it from the edit screen. there is a Sharpen tool here, but I find they wrote these programs probably in stages, and I like the program better from the main edit screen. So we're going to go back to that. We're going to go to Adjustments, and there's the Sharpen tool there. And it will default to a certain amount. So we're just going to put that back to zero. I'm going to do a side-by-side comparison so you can see. And then I'm just going to really wham this amount over quite far to the right, so that when I drag this across, hopefully you'll be able to see the difference between the sharpen and the non-sharpen. So it's not going to sharpen a photo that's out of focus. It won't do miracles. It's not that much advanced AI in it, but it will help if it's just slightly out of focus, or if it's a situation like this where you just want to really bring out the texture of the feathers, perhaps. So I'll just zoom in a little bit so you see it better. And it is sometimes really nice to just sharpen a bird's eye, beak, or something like that. So I find it handy for wildlife. And then, up to Alan and Chris, do you want me to do I'll do one more sharpening example, and then I can go on and do some clone stuff.
Alan, you have a better sense of timing on the deck than I do.
I think I would leave the cloning stuff till next week, maybe.
Okay. All right. I'll just give you one more example on the sharpening, and then I will be done. So here's an example where you can see I might have just had a little bit of hand motion in with my camera, and it didn't quite get a really sharp, crisp image. So in this situation, I'm going to use this brush. I'll bring it over, and again, it doesn't have to be really drastic, but it just brings some of the veins of the leaves in the pistil into sharper focus. So it's a bit of a photo rescue in that instance. Okay, that's it. I will stop my share.
Yes, and then Stuart says the sum of your edits, there was a countdown from the software. What's the hardware you're using?
Sorry, I don't know. What did he say?
I think he's wondering what kind of chip on memory you have on your computer, I think. How fast it is, basically.
Well, it's fast on any computer I've used. I mean, I use it on a laptop. I've used it on other people's computers that are just in Windows 8 or something, that older computers. I've never had a speed issue with it. Now, the only thing that you might notice slowing down on is the spot removal, because it is doing some calculations, right? So that might be a little slower, but I haven't noticed anything. Like, I'm not sitting around waiting for dots. You know, you're not going to wait 10 seconds per dot. That I have never seen that problem. So, but I get what you're saying. But yeah, any computer that was built in the last 7 years or 8 years, it wouldn't have any problem at all.
Yeah, Chris, well, do you remember anything? Almost have sharp eyes because I didn't see the countdown. Okay, thanks very much, Linda. So we'll see more next week, I guess.
Okay.
Okay, so next up, I have a question that came in about Linux. Peter has a Lenovo laptop with a solid state drive, and he's got two Linux distros on it, Mint and Deepin. But he has a problem changing the default operating. So when he boots the computer, which one does it boot into? Right now it boots into Deepin. He would like it to boot into Mint, and he's asking, does he need to delete Deepin to do that? The answer is no. You can actually change the grub menu, the boot menu. There are two ways to do it. A few years ago, I would do it manually, and you would have to go in and play with a bunch of script files. And in particular, this one down here, 30OS Prober, is the one that actually runs around your hard drive and finds all the operating systems that are on it, and then creates the menu items in grub. And then the custom file allows you to tell it what you would like it to do. So you have to actually, you know, dig into the weeds here get into these script files and modify them manually to make it do what you want. But there's a much easier way than that. There's a program called Grub Customizer. And Grub Customizer, basically, you just download, install it, and run it. And it basically lists, it does that running around the operating system, find out which operating systems are available on your drive. So here's Mint in one partition, here's Windows 10 in a second, a different partition. And I have it set so that Mint is the default. Well, typically when you install Linux, you install it after you've installed Windows. And when you install Linux, it wants to be the default boot option. But if you want to change it so that Windows is the default boot option, it's really easy in this package. You just click on Windows to select it, like I've got Mint here, and then you use the up arrow here to just pump up Windows to the top of the list, and then Windows will be the default, and you always have the option to dual boot into Mint, because the Grub menu gives you a countdown, a 10-second window by default, so that it waits for 10 seconds to see if you want to change your mind, and then it boots into the default operating system. So you can change the default just here on the screen. And you can also get rid of things that you don't want. Here was a version of Ubuntu or something, which I dragged off and got rid of that. So it's really quite flexible in terms of how you want to run the thing. Okay, final thing we have in the pipeline tonight is another episode of my Can We Speed Up an Old Windows Computer? And if you remember, we were playing with PC Manager a few weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, before I got sidetracked onto that bleach bit nonsense. And we've been looking at how to clean up disks, basically. And we tried a bunch of different options in PC Manager. We looked at Boost, this blue button here, which didn't seem to do anything. We tried the health check. And we looked at storage management and could we recover this 2.1 gigabytes that it was telling us about. And cleanup, it turns out, isn't really an option. It's just these are tabs. So you can tab to security or you can tab back to cleanup. So that's really not a useful option. Anyway, we tried all these things right here to see how we could clean up the disk, and we found that the Boost item was basically useless. The health check got rid of some files, but it doesn't do ones that are available in disk cleanup. And then we looked at storage management, and we found that that was actually quite useful because we'd find large files and some that I'd forgotten all about, really big files. However, you have to review them all because a whole bunch of them are system files, and you probably don't want to get rid of those. And whatever you do, it seems as though it doesn't get rid of the stuff that's sitting in the disk cleanup utility and the system files. So wherever you run these things, you still have to go and run disk cleanup. However, we can still go into the storage management option and see what it does for us. We looked at health check. And we looked at managing large files. The next option is managing applications. And it says remove rarely used apps to save space. Now, as you might guess, this really just loads the one of the Windows tools, which you can get from settings and apps, and then you will get a list of apps. And by default, it lists them by name, so they're in alphabetical order. And if you're interested in trying to save disk space, what you can do is use this little chevron here and change that so it displays them by size. And then you can see that the biggest app I've got on my system is GIMP, the image editor, which to me was surprising. It takes over a gigabyte of storage, but Chris tells me that's pretty typical for image editors. They like lots of storage space. LibreOffice is almost a gig, but I use LibreOffice a lot, so I'm not getting rid of that. Now, PowerCharge is a bit of a, I whined about that before. It takes almost 700 meg, and I only use two of the modules. MapSource is for my Garmin GPS, so I can't really get rid of that. So, but when I look down here, I find some things. I find Microsoft OneDrive. It's taking 300 meg, and I don't use it. So if I were to right-click on Microsoft OneDrive, it would pop up this window here, which would let me uninstall the app, and I can save myself 300 meg. So that's a good thing, and sure enough, now you'll see that OneDrive, Microsoft OneDrive, right, in alphabetical order, doesn't appear anymore. However, another one that's interesting is Microsoft Silverlight. Now, I seem to remember that Silverlight's taking a quarter of a gigabyte. I seem to remember that Silverlight actually has been deprecated. So I checked on the web, and sure enough, it ran out of support in October 2021, like 3 years ago, 2 years ago. but Microsoft forgot to take it off Windows 10, apparently. But again, I can get rid of that. And the same kind of thing with Cortana. I don't use Cortana. I am allowed to uninstall it. It's only taking 81K. But again, Microsoft's going to get rid of Cortana. So if you're in Windows 11, you won't be seeing Cortana anymore. However, they are going to retain it in Windows 10. So I'm still stuck with it unless I decide to uninstall it. So basically, there's somewhere where you can look at the apps that are available. Clearly, you have to decide which ones you want, which ones you're willing to get rid of. But then you can delete some of the apps, uninstall some of the apps, and create some space. And also, they won't sit in your startup menu and start up in the background if they're not installed anymore, for example. Okay, the other thing in this storage manager option is a thing called Storage Sense. And you'll find sometimes that this thing kicks in and says, oh, you're low on disk space. How would you like to start up Storage Sense and have it automatically do stuff? I always decline that because I don't like things that do things automatically. However, I decided, I think it was Jeff suggested I take a look at this, so I took a look, and it says it will run when disk space is low if it's activated, not to have it turned off. We'll clean up enough space to help your system run its best, and we haven't used it because I haven't run it. But it will delete temporary files that aren't being used, and you can choose how many, 30 days in the recycle bin. In the downloads folder, you can choose never, for example. So basically, I looked up Storage Sense, and if you look at the Microsoft website, you'll find an article on how it actually runs. And it's basically turned off by default. If you enable it, then it monitors your disk space and decides when the disk space is too low. And then it will automatically remove temporary files, the recycle bin contents, and items in the download folder according to the criteria which you've set. If you want to, you can specify drives other than the system disk. So if you have a second drive, for example, you can have it clean up that one for you. As I said, the settings determine what's deleted, but it also does it when. So you can choose a weekly, monthly, and 15, 30 days for recycle bin, etc., etc. Here's the thing that I didn't like about it. It can turn itself on automatically if disk space is low, but it will at least warn you. So you have the option to say yay or nay when it wants to actually run. So settings and storage. Here it is, and if you look at the actual storage option here, you can see what various categories of files are taking space. And again, you can decide, for example, I've got 300 megabytes of temporary files. And interestingly, I've got unused local accounts are taking a gigabyte. Not actually sure what that is, but something obviously I should look at. So those are kind of things that you can do in terms of cleaning up disk space and managing your applications. And next time we have a look at this thing, we'll take a look and see what else PC Manager can do for us. Okay, so that's everything I had in the pipe. Chris has been monitoring the chat assiduously, I'm sure. Is there any questions that we have, Chris?
Nope, I haven't seen any other questions. I did paste in, if anybody was interested, the system requirements for Photoscape X. And interestingly, I couldn't find the details at the Photoscape website, but somebody else did post it, and it's rather modest, 4 gig of RAM. And it also takes a lot of disk space, 700 megabytes of free disk space for the installation. They say an Intel Pentium i3. Obviously, they don't know what they're talking about. Pentium is not Core i, but they say multi-core gigahertz or higher, so who knows what that really means. But I can attest to the fact that it does run on rather modest space. Tom mentions that if you're looking for performance, if you have a hard drive, simplest speed up is a solid-state drive, and also increasing your RAM if you can. If you only have 4 gigabytes of RAM, going up to 8 or 16 or even 64 gig is better. I can attest to that, except that going to 32 and 64 gigs of RAM, you're probably, most people are not going to see a performance increase out of that. It's not that it's bad to have, but it's not going to really speed things up an awful lot. But getting up to at least 16 can make a big difference. Jeff has a question. Today, both Nancy and I received an SMS notification messages on our respective cell phones, which read Deep Link. We did not click on the notification, though Nancy did, but did go through my text messaging program. There was nothing there. Any ideas? So if anybody has an idea on that, you can pipe in. And Tristan says the local user information listed in disk cleanup is normally the user profile data, so desktop, documents, downloads, photos, etc. That's a good pointer. And EO Driscoll, slow computers, at least two of my family. Thanks for the tips. And Tom says still Word is reinstalling each time I start. So Tom mentioned that he had a problem where Word is reinstalling. And this is one of those phantom things that I find if you use a program that will restore a Windows configuration to new hardware, weird things happen. And I had problems and I swore I'll never do it again. If I get a new computer, I let it do the out-of-box installation of Windows. I manually reinstall all my applications. And then I get the data back from my backups. But I've had too many times where if I tried to restore a Windows configuration to another computer, just strange things happen, like Tom is having, where Word is reinstalling each time you start. On that regard, I would probably suggest seeing if you can do a repair on Office.
I did that.
Okay. And failing that, uninstalling and reinstalling Office completely, I think, is the route I would go.
Now, Excel works, but Word wants to reinstall every time. I suppose I could try reinstalling. I'm not sure. I think I have the original disk, the CD, to load it in. Do you keep all your installation files for programs you use?
I typically do. I try to religiously do that. And I have on a scratch drive that I have that I don't really care. I don't back it up. If it goes away, it goes away. But I will keep installation media on there. And I have many gigabytes of files, probably into close to a terabyte of files that are the original installation media for all my programs.
And just a note on this, you know, cleaning up the disk and trying to get storage. For most people, that's not an issue because you probably have a terabyte drive and you might be using 115 gig or something. Yeah. Most people have got tons and tons of disk space. It's just when I started with SSDs, for example, I mean, my first SSD was 60 gigabytes and I was running Windows and Linux in a dual boot setup and then my data drive on top of that. So space was always at a premium. And even now, I think my SSD is 250 gig and it's dual booting, but I've actually got lots of space. So I'm not really worried about GIMP taking 1 gigabyte, for example. But I like to be, I like things to be efficient and tidy. So trying to get rid of stuff which I don't use is always a good thing to do, I think.
Yeah, that's something everybody should do.
Sorry?
I think that's something everybody should do. I mean, like you, Alan, I mean, my photo editing program takes up many gigabytes. And I don't mind that because I use the program and that's fine. But if it's some program that's just wasting disk space and I don't use it, yeah, get rid of it.
Okay. So Tom had asked to explain grub. So for those of you who don't know, when you install Linux, you install Linux on a second partition on your hard drive. So you've got drive C, which is the Windows operating system and all the applications and stuff. You have a second partition with Linux. And when you boot the computer, you have to decide which operating system you want to run. You can only run one operating system at a time. So grub is a grand unified boot menu. So when you boot your computer having installed Linux, it actually pops up a boot screen, and it's a boot menu screen. So at the top on mine, it says Linux Mint, and then the second entry down is Windows 10. If I don't do anything, in 10 seconds, the machine will boot into the first option, i.e. Linux. If I use the down arrow key, I select Windows. If I then hit enter, the machine will boot into Windows. And that magic is basically grub. Grub has got the details of where those two bootloaders are on the hard drive. So it knows when I select Linux to go to this portion of the drive and run that operating system. Or if I choose Windows, then it says go to that portion of the drive and run Windows. So grub is basically a boot menu system when you dual boot Windows and Linux. Okay, anything else, anybody?
I didn't see anything in the chat, so if somebody put something in the chat and we haven't raised it, jump in again.
So Tristan is saying instead of dual booting, he's using virtual machines. So he installs Windows and then runs Linux on a virtual machine. And then, of course, you can run Linux without rebooting. Or you can do the opposite, as he says. The only thing there is you're running a virtual machine, so it can be a bit slower, maybe, on some hardware. And you have to set the thing up, too, which is not necessarily as easy as setting up a dual boot system, believe me. Okay, we're just about at 8:30, which is our 1 hour magic number. So let me just tell you that if you have questions for next week or things that you would like to share, like Bob and Linda, send us some details of your question or follow-ups to things that have been talked about tonight, topics that you'd like to share, send it to our suggestion box address, and we'll be sure to add you into the agenda. So next week, it will be October the 4th. It'll be our first Q&A in October. Next Wednesday, as usual, October the 4th, 7:30, and we'll see you there. So thanks for attending tonight. Hope you found it interesting, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. Bye. Have a good week.